You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network, where we're all about real news and great conversation. We're having a big conversation this afternoon because, in this lawyer's opinion, Donald Trump has now plunged us into a very real constitutional crisis. He has initiated a coup, and he did so over the weekend. The coup has been happening, but I think now it's not debatable. He may be an elected president, but a president's powers are limited. He is not a king. In America, the law is king. And the law, our Constitution, has some limits to a president's authority. And the branch of government that often decides where those lines are is the judiciary, is the judicial branch. But Donald Trump and his minions have been saying for quite some time that they don't care what the judiciary says. And in fact, his immigration czar, Tom Homan, yes, that Mensa member, said over the weekend, "I don't care what the judges think." Excuse me, this was Monday. On a Fox News interview, "I don't care what the judges think." That's what he had to say. So when we put all of this together, what you've got is an administration that is actively and intentionally violating a court's orders. And not a court's order about some ticky-tacky little thing. A court order about whether or not a president can invoke the Alien Enemies Act at whim and deport people without any due process. That is where we're at. So I'm going to go through the timeline. I just briefly want to remind everyone that the crux of the basic legal issue here is, can a president just say, "Yep, yeah, I'm going to invoke the Alien Enemies Act, even though we are not in war, and I am going to use it to deport
criminals"? Yeah, Meg's having a little bit of technical issues there. Her mic was breaking up, but she's talking about President Donald Trump intentionally violating or willfully violating the Alien and Enemies Act and deporting people without due process. Tell us your concerns. Call in. We want to hear from you. You can call in at 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. Call in and tell us what you think. Maggie's back.
Hey, Cal. Thanks so much for the help there. Today, just again, little glitch in the matrix this afternoon. The Alien Enemies Act permits a president to arrest, imprison, or deport people older than 14 who come from a foreign enemy country. It's only been used in the War of 1812 and the first two World Wars. By the way, it was used to intern Japanese Americans. So we're not at war with Venezuela. We're not at war with El Salvador. There's no declaration of war by Congress. So that country isn't a stated enemy or an antagonist. Neither of them are to the United States. It doesn't apply. But that's if we're even having a reasoned argument about the Alien Enemies Act. What has become the much more pressing legal issue, what has amounted to the constitutional crisis, is, of course, the fact that he has defied a court order. Here is the timeline. at 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, Judge Boasberg asked the administration in a hearing what was going to happen in the next 24 to 48 hours. So news that Donald Trump had issued this executive order invoking the Alien Enemies Act late on Friday, that he was planning to deport some like 200 alleged Venezuelan gang members, that had leaked out. And so the ACLU and another organization filed a lawsuit to stop it. The judge convenes a hearing on Saturday afternoon, 5 o'clock, says, what's going on to the government? The government basically said, they're not sure. You think you might want to know that. Might want to be apprised of some facts. At 5:22, the judge ordered a break in the hearing on Saturday so that the government attorney could get the facts and the judge could rule. By the way, at 5:45, a flight took off. So even there, one of these three flights taking off as this hearing is going on, as the court is asking for information from the government attorney who says they don't know, that's just in bad faith. The idea that you would, oh, I don't know, and a flight takes off while you're in the very hearing to determine whether or not the flight should take off is a big deal. Before 6:52 on Saturday afternoon, the judge agreed that the terms of the Alien Enemies Act apply only to, quote, enemy nations, you know, like it says in the law. And since neither Venezuela nor El Salvador are enemy nations, it doesn't apply and it cannot be used to deport these people without any due process. And the judge blocked deportations under it. Here's what he said at approximately, again, this was 6:52, quote, any plane containing these folks that is going to take off or is in the air needs to be returned to the United States. These people need to be returned to the United States. That is when, again, White House officials, according to reporting by Mark Caputo, after those words were said, actually had a discussion about whether to order two of the planes that were in the air to turn around, but the administration chose not to. The judge had issued an oral order from the bench. The administration said, should we do what the judge told us to do? Answer, no, we're not going to do that. That is insane. And again, that hearing began like late afternoon around like 4, 4:30. The first plane took off not until 5:26 p.m. The second plane took off at 6:44 p.m. And here's what's really important, folks. Here's what's really important. The third plane had not yet left. Two planes were in the air when the judge issued the order from the bench. The administration elected not to turn those around. At 7:26 p.m., the judge's written order granting the injunction sought by the ACLU and directing the administration to not deport these people was entered on the docket. That happened at 7:26 p.m. And 10 minutes later, ladies and gentlemen, the flight took off. The third flight took off. The order was entered on the docket 7:26 p.m. At 7:36 p.m., 10 minutes later, the flight took off. And that is the constitutional crisis. To our texter on the text line, I have to repeat this over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Most of our constitutional rights apply to persons, not citizens. So yes, someone here illegally has a right to due process. That is, texter, why the president had to invoke the Alien Enemies Act, because it is the Alien Enemies Act that strips even someone here illegally, strips the due process rights away from them. So texter, you're wrong, and I know you're wrong because that's not what the Constitution says, and B, that's not how the Trump administration operated. It was a tacit admission that people here illegally are entitled to due process when he invoked the Alien Enemies Act. You see how that all sticks together? Kelvin and Jamie, Kelvin on the board, Jamie, my senior producer listening in, let me know if I'm not explaining that clearly. But again, most of our rights under the Constitution inure to people. That is the word, or persons is the word that is used, not citizens. For example, the right to vote, that's restricted to citizens. But due process, First Amendment rights, those are all attached to persons, whether citizens or not. I don't know where you're getting that from. You need to learn all the facts yourself. So again, this is the point. Those 10 minutes between the entering of the court's order and when that third plane took off, that's the coup. That's the overthrow. That's the trashing of our Constitution. And by the way, again, there were two planes in the air that could have been turned around. The Trump administration knew that. They talked about it. They decided to defy the court's oral ruling. This is apparently what they're all hanging their hats on, that the planes were already in the air. That is absolutely hogwash. So what is being done about this? Todd from DePere wants to know. So the most recent action was that Judge Boasberg told the Trump administration on Monday that they had to respond by noon yesterday with more detailed answers to his questions about when did the planes take off? When was this communicated? How did you know this? And by the way, Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, has only really addressed the first two planes. They aren't addressing the third plane. And when asked in the Monday hearing about, well, when exactly did the third plane take off? The Justice Department lawyer refused to answer the questions, claiming that he wasn't authorized, claiming national security secrets. The judge offered to do it in a SCIF, in a secured compartmentalized information facility, and that was ignored and declined. So they're saying, we're not going to comply. On Tuesday, the lawyers went back into the courtroom, again, failed to provide the information that was ordered to be provided on Monday. And Judge Boasberg, again, yesterday ordered the Justice Department to send him under seal the information that he has been seeking. That was supposed to be submitted just hours ago, just before I was getting on the air, everybody. And so here is where we're at. Please keep an eye on this. I will continue to discuss. We've got Jason Stein joining me coming up from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, because right here in Wisconsin, we're about to declare our values in the state's next biennial budget. Amy from Madison, we're going to put your question in the hopper. I'll see if I can get to it tomorrow. Keep it locked. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. This great discussion continues after these quick messages. 855-752-4842. 855-75-CIVIC. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I want to thank all of our texters and the folks participating in the discussion about what I consider to be now a full-blown constitutional crisis. We have maybe witnessed a coup here in this country without a single bullet being fired. I wanted to answer two brief texters. One texter talking about the liberal judge who ordered the Trump administration to turn the planes around. That wasn't a liberal judge. That judge was appointed by George W. Bush. Last time I checked, that's a Republican and a conservative. Just saying. Second question was from Amy. We could just get enough time to squeeze it in here, so I wanted to answer your question. Amy from Madison says this: can any members of the Trump administration involved in the flouting of the court orders be arrested for breaking our laws? Amy, that is the scene that I never want to witness. Technically speaking, the U.S. Marshals Service is the law enforcement arm that is charged with executing judicial orders. But guess who controls the U.S. Marshals Service? The President of the United States. That seems to be where we're moving towards. And I just want to be clear. Courts absolutely have jurisdiction over presidents. Yes, they do. And with that, we are going to bring on my very special next guest, Jason Stein, from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You're going to make us all smarter because even I, who like a lot of detail and a lot of nerdy facts and a lot of legislative process, even I can get lost, dazed, and confused in the state biennial budget process. So thanks so much for making time, Jason. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's start with the basics. When can we start to see the budget hearings really getting underway? If people are interested in this stuff, where should they be looking if they want to keep an eye on things as they develop?
The budget, the governor put forward the budget in mid-February. Any day now, we'll get from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau their nonpartisan analysis of the state budget. And then you'll see in April, hearings start in the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, which is their budget writing committee. And then the amendments will start in late May, you know, kind of early June. Then you'll get floor votes in, you know, June, maybe into early July. And then, you know, the budget will typically go to the governor's desk late June, early July.
It's a long process. If you have a lot of free time on your hands, you want to watch the hearings, you can find the Joint Finance Committee hearings on Wisconsin Eye. They sometimes are pretty fascinating. Other moments, it's like watching paint dry. But again, that's where you find it. I also, folks, to give you another source, I think Wisconsin Watch does a hell of a job reporting on it. Obviously, the Wisconsin Policy Forum, you have more in-depth, not sort of daily reporting, but you give us the bigger analysis. And most importantly, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, these nonpartisan, apolitical organizations that do these analyses. Again, portions will be very dry, but there will be some highlights in that. And again, their job is to present an unbiased, very objective report of the governor and of the budget that is proposed. So a really good resource. So Jason, let's start with the top line on the proposed budget and the overall fiscal health of the state. People have been talking about these big surpluses for a long time now. Are we still in all signs pointing to good territory, or is the landscape changing?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the landscape is changing somewhat. I mean, we've been exceptionally good. You know, 2 years ago, we had a $7 billion general fund balance. That's, you know, our main set of accounts for the state of Wisconsin that takes in income and sales tax dollars and pays for education, healthcare, University of Wisconsin, state prisons. And that will be down from 2 years ago at the end of, you know, June, it'll be down to about $4.25 billion. So, you know, there's already been a $3 billion drop over the past couple years, and that would intensify under the governor's budget, you know, probably under whatever the legislature puts forward too, I would suspect. You know, the legislature, or the governor, excuse me, in his proposal wants to have spending increases over the 2 years of around 20%. And that is much more than we've ever seen in the past. Even the current budget, which is, you know, at a basically generational high in terms of a percentage spending increase. So you add that together with the possibility of tax cuts, big tax cuts by the legislature that are not necessarily sustainable, and the possibility that we could dip into a national recession as well, given where we're at. I think there's reason to be cautious here in the next few months. Things have been very good for the state. We want it to stay that way. And so obviously we want to spend down some of our surplus, but how much and how many commitments do we want to take on, and can we sustain them even if the economy goes into recession? It's worth thinking about that.
We're going to talk with Jason Stein from the Wisconsin Policy Forum about some of those conflicts between the governor's proposed budget, some of these spending increases in education and other places, mental health resources, the fact that Republicans are saying no. You know, again, budgets, budget surpluses, deficits defined by both revenues and expenditures. We have to look at both columns. And to whom, if you're talking about tax cuts, to whom does the bulk of the benefit of those tax cuts accrue, right? Both on an absolute dollar and sort of an effective tax rate basis as well. We've got, again, Jason Stein with us from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Do you have a question about the state's biennial budget process? Have you ever wondered, what the hell is the Vanna White veto? We'll talk about all of that with our very special guest, Jason Stein. You can join us 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. We're going to keep it locked. We got Pam Yonke coming up with our farm update. We'll be right back with Jason and me and you and your questions. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Welcome back, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We've got Jason Stein with us from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, helping us all understand the state's pretty complicated biennial budget process a little better. Jason, one of the, for the wonks, one of the most frequently talked about little artifact of our budgeting process, infamous artifact, I may say, is what is called the Vanna White veto. And so for all of our listeners at home who haven't ever heard of this, can you explain what it is and how it was most recently used, much to the surprise of many folks?
Yeah, it was surprising, I think, and is surprising to people when they find out how much power the Wisconsin governor has with the veto pen. Formerly, you know, governors like Tommy Thompson actually had the ability to strike out individual letters and words and make new words that had not been there before. That power was eventually removed. But then governors retained the power to still strike out keywords, make, you know, new sentences, stitch two sentences together. You know, they could remove the not from thou shalt not kill to completely change the meaning of that sentence. And there was something called the Frankenstein veto that was, again, taking two sentences and making them into one. That was also shut down through a constitutional amendment. But then still, Tony Evers to this day retains, you know, among, if not the most powerful partial veto pen in the country. So he still, you know, really has a remarkable ability to change what the legislature sends him, but it's only for bills that have an appropriation in them.
Yes. And can you explain to people what's the difference between an appropriation and other budget terms that we hear? Do people really need to understand that? Or can we think in our head, it's an appropriation that's spending?
Correct. Essentially, you know, there's money that is set aside in a bill for a specific purpose, an appropriation, and that triggers his ability to have the partial veto pen. And the reason, the thinking to that was that it allows the chief executive of the state, the governor, to have some say with a budget bill about, you know, to lower spending. But, you know, it has also had the effect of giving governors of both parties this ability to set policy through their veto that is, I think, when you explain it to people, they generally are very surprised and shocked at the extent of it.
The breadth of the power of that partial veto. Right. it was most, or perhaps most recently, and perhaps most infamously used by the governor to try to increase educational spending for quite some time. Let's talk about educational spending in this current biennial budget proposal from the governor. We've heard Speaker Voss say in recent interviews that the last biennium saw a once-in-a-generation increase in educational spending. Democrats have argued that that's, while there was an increase in spending, there really had been a slow sort of bleed in educational funding over a very long period. So it was trying to get right-size the funding level. Sure. Tell us what the core conflict is in this budget when it comes to educational funding, and who's right when it comes to this state's investment in public education viewed over the last, say, 15 to 20 years, of course, adjusted for inflation and increasing costs, as you will, Jason.
Yeah. So there's something called revenue limits that limit the amount of funding that school districts can take in from local property taxes and state general school aids on a per pupil basis. And those have been kept tighter than the rate of inflation in recent years, which inflation has been, you know, very rapid. And, you know, school districts have not fully caught up or kept up with that rate of inflation in recent years. And one thing you've had happen is, you know, the legislature in the past has really controlled how much school funding rose with those revenue limits. But increasingly, those are going up more rapidly than the legislature had expected or determined because of local referenda, and especially big ones. You had $250 million one pass in Milwaukee. You had $100 million one pass in Madison in 2024. And so I think, you know, one of the big questions is the legislature is sort of losing control of local school funding. And what's happening then is it's going on to local property taxes. And how are they going to react to that? The governor's reaction is to do a very, very large multi-billion dollar state aid increase to districts. The legislature is clearly not going to sign on for most of that. What are they going to do in response? And that's kind of what we need to wait and see.
Is there some bit of objectively observable irony, Jason, in the Republicans' current view and there'd been legislation introduced to strip away from local communities their right to increase school funding through referenda, while at the same time arguing for local control? It seems to be a bit in conflict. So that's question one. Question two is, do you have any prognostication? Would you like to go on the record, my friend, and give us where you think the funding might end up and help us see that in context of what the needs are within the schools? It is somewhere in the middle ground. Is that going to be able to get it done, or are local districts still going to be experiencing a pinch?
Sure. First off, to your question, you know, there has been some legislation in recent cycles to at least pare back referendum opportunities for districts. I mean, I think by and large, though, those really haven't had much significant impact, I would say, on the ability of districts to go to referendum. You know, if the legislature were to do legislation that would really impact that, I don't think the governor would sign it. So in this session, I don't think you're going to see anything happen in that regard. Under the governor had this partial veto that you talked, that you alluded to in 2 years ago, that essentially set up for hundreds of years to come, in theory, a $325 per pupil increase in each, you know, every year in the revenue limit. That really puts some pressure, I think, on both sides to get a deal on education, and not just on that, but on the state budget overall, because if no budget passes, you get that $325 increase, which is maybe like, I don't know, 2.8%, something like that, increase in the average statewide revenue limit for school districts. And that, if there's no additional state aid approved, district school boards could choose to raise property taxes by that additional amount. And I think both the governor and legislature would be reluctant to have that happen. Yes. So maybe that puts a little more pressure on them, both sides, to get a budget and not just have no budget at all. I think the most likely scenario is that school districts are continue to feel like they have not gotten enough in the state budget because, you know, they've been pretty unhappy with where things have been at. And, you know, but so you're probably going to see more referenda, which we'll report on the April referenda when those come, when we get those results.
Yes.
And also, I think, you know, some unhappy property taxpayers, because you are seeing upward pressure on property taxes because of all this. So we'll see. But that's, I think, probably where the safest money would be for now.
Appreciate that. Again, folks, if you're just joining us, I've got Jason Stein of the beloved Wisconsin Policy Forum with us to delve deep into the state's biennial budget process, which is getting underway. I want to turn to, in just a minute, the trickle-down impacts, an actual trickle-down impact of the federal spending cuts and where Wisconsinites might see and feel those. Are they making adjustments in the state budget for that? But I wanted to ask you first this question. How common is a biennial budget for state governments? We get it done for 2 years, but I, and this is genuinely, Jason, I have no idea what the answer is because I'm not super familiar with other state budget processes.
That's a great question. It's been a while since I've looked at it. There are definitely many states that also do a 2-year process. There are some that do an annual process. Wisconsin used to do an annual budget. Yep. I think it was in the 60s that we went to a 2-year budget. And because it, you know, it's a time consuming process. It goes from like February to July. Yes. So then to be doing that every year, it's a pretty heavy lift. So that's why we went to the 2-year process.
Yeah, but I like biennial budgets. Having worked in a local government, there's so much effort and energy that is sucked into those budget processes that, you know, the biennial seems to make good sense. So actual trickle down impacts of the federal spending cuts. Are we seeing adjustments in the state budget for those? What can Wisconsin residents expect?
I think we're still in the zone of not really knowing what's happening. I mean, you know, and litigation and back and forth. Yes. And there's so many cases and they're somewhat contradictory. Although the results, I have not seen many, if any, results that are suggesting that the administration has broad powers to avoid making expenditures that are essentially appropriated within the federal budget and within federal law. But that being said, there certainly could be a whole variety of impacts to, you know, the state, either because of funding delays or funding cuts that might eventually be approved by Congress. And all this research is available on our website for free if people want to look it out at wispolicyforum.org. But we do have a chart in our budget brief on the state that looks at what the exposure is or what is the level of federal funding by agency. And it's really in the Department of Health Services that you have the big systemic risk for the state. This health services budget is, you know, roughly $40 million. And of that, about $25 billion is Medicaid and food share, which is a successor to food stamp funding and some other programs. So it's really in Medicaid. I mean, the next biggest agency at the UW system is under $4 billion. So, you know, it's almost like an order of magnitude. Or, you know, if you want to think about it, the Department of Health Services has more than really all the other state agencies put together, is another way to think about it. So that's really the thing to watch, is Medicaid health coverage for the needy, as well as, to a much lesser extent, food share funding.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary when you just think of the sheer size of those budget numbers compared to the other line items and departmental spending at the feds. I wanted to cue in on this, and you'll have just about a minute or so, Jason. And that is, how about the uncertainty? Are there any discussions that you've heard of? Are there any mechanisms within state law if funding is, say, in litigation, if there's just uncertainty, if it doesn't get released, do we have other ways to supplement, for example, those funding sources if the money is not forthcoming from the feds?
Well, we do have, you know, this very large general fund balance, which I think retaining some of that could be helpful because it can float us for these things. And a lot of federal funding works that way anyway. It works on a reimbursement basis, as you know, from your time in county government. So I think that's one reason why, you know, the state should really think about retaining some reserves that it can use for that purpose. But in some cases, they may not have under state law the ability to do that. And that's still something we're trying to, you know, get a better handle on.
Jason, it's one of those things. This is all hearkening back to like 2020 times. Like, this has never happened before. Everybody's looking around. What do we do now? Gee whiz. Unprecedented is now a very precedented word. Thanks so much to Jason Stein from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You can find out more at wispolicyforum.org. We're going to take care of our last bit of business this afternoon. I'm going to be right back with you about the silencing of the voice of America. Those thoughts coming up next right here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. Can't believe we're already here. End of the day. We got Dom Salvia coming up next right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I wanted to talk about Donald Trump ending, for all intents and purposes, the voice of America. This happened over the weekend. He signed an executive order, dismantled a bunch of federal agencies, including the agency that oversees Voice of America, as well as Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia. It's pretty shocking. And I get Charlie Sykes's Substack, and he quoted Edward R. Murrow in response to this, and he reminded us that Edward R. Murrow said this, one of our nation's most revered broadcasters, that a nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves. And if you have never heard of the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe or Asia or all any of these things, as well as Radio Liberty, this organization has an annual budget of $270 million. It has more than 2,000 employees. But here's why. It broadcasts in 49 languages across the world and has a weekly estimated audience of more than 361 million people. More people than live in the United States of America. In effect, the cuts have ended Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia, and Radio Liberty. Michael Abramowitz, the director of Voice of America, wrote this on social media. VOA promotes freedom and democracy around the world by telling America's story and providing objective and balanced news and information, especially for those living under tyranny. He added this, for more than 80 years, Voice of America has been a priceless asset for the United States, playing an essential role in the fight against communism, fascism, and oppression, and in the fight for freedom and democracy around the world. Millions of people, hundreds of millions of people every week tune in. And millions of people for the last 83 years have been doing just that. Going to the Voice of America, going to Radio Free Asia, Radio Free Europe for objective coverage as a reliable information source, sometimes about what's happening in their very own countries. During the Cold War, ask your grandparents if you have relatives that were still in Europe through these decades in the Cold War, leading up to the fall of the former Soviet Union in 1988 into 1989. Ask them if they listened to Radio Free Europe. They did. I nearly promise you that. Radio Free Europe and these broadcast outlets are amongst the things, the catalysts that helped people in the former Soviet Union oppose that regime. It has inspired dissident movements to fight autocrats and dictators across the world. Charlie Sykes shared in his Substack that his own parents were among the many Soviet citizens from that period of time who clandestinely listened to Voice of America broadcasts and Radio Free Europe broadcasts, and that helped solidify their opposition to the Soviet regime, to that dictatorship. And of course, unsurprisingly, who was celebrating the end of Radio Free Asia, Radio Free Europe, Liberty Radio, and Voice of America? Ah, yes. Russian propagandists and Chinese propagandists. As the Russian opposition leader Vladimir Kara-Murza put it, this move by the Trump administration is, quote, one more champagne bottle opened in the Kremlin. It further estranges the Trump administration from our Western allies, from other liberal democracies, and aligns us and Donald Trump ever more with despots and autocrats like Putin and oppressive regimes like Xi Jinping in China. Of course, here's from China, the Global Times, which is a Communist Party newspaper, denounced Voice of America as a, quote, frontline propaganda tool and a lie factory. Quote, almost every malicious falsehood about China has VOA's fingerprints all over it. Lovely. One bit of a silver lining. You know who Trump appointed to lead Voice of America and now is apparently out of a job? Carrie Lake. So one small silver lining on that cloud. Yes. Karma is sometimes, you know, we'll go with Schadenfreude. Little Schadenfreude for Carrie Lake. She's apparently out of a job. That's going to do it for me today. I'll be back tomorrow. You got Dom Salvia up next. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good afternoon. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it is always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.